Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present human rights activist and torture survivor Orlando Tizon, who explains why he and other victims of torture protested the nomination of Alberto Gonzalez to be Attorney General at a recent Senate confirmation hearing. Bob Fitrakis, an attorney disputing the results of the presidential election in Ohio, who assesses the historical significance of a formal challenge lodged in Congress against Ohio's electoral votes. And singer-songwriter Stephen Smith, who talks about his conversations with family members living in Iraq. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Indonesian Army will begin restricting delivery of disaster relief to Aceh Province, the area hardest hit by Asia's tsunami, according to the BBC News. Aid workers will be required to register before traveling to areas outside of Banda Aceh and Mulabo because the Army says it cannot guarantee their safety. The head of Indonesia's army, General Endriatono Surtarto, accused the pro-independence Free Aceh Movement, or GAM, of stealing aid bound for outlying areas. GAM spokesman Sofyan Dawood has stated that GAM is comprised of people from Aceh and will not obstruct the delivery of relief supplies. Meanwhile, there have been no reports of rebel interference from any of the relief organizations working outside the main towns. Prior to December 26th, Aceh had been under emergency rule and was closed to both aid agencies and the international media. The decades-long dispute between Indonesia's military force and GAM culminated in a 2003 military offensive against the rebels. Some 10,000 Acehnese have been killed in the conflict since 1989. Aid agencies hope the travel restrictions or renewed skirmishes between the Indonesian military and the rebels won't impede the flow of aid so badly needed by the victims of the tsunami in Aceh, where an estimated 100,000 people died. While a record $4 billion in emergency aid has been pledged for the victims of the Indian Ocean tsunami, children continue to die in the man-made disaster that is consuming the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Each week, several thousand children die in the Congo, according to an estimate by the International Rescue Committee, which cites the cause as war-induced disease and starvation. The Associated Press reports that renewed fighting along the border with Rwanda has forced 150,000 villagers to flee into the jungle. Meanwhile, international aid to the Congo totaled $188 million in 2004, roughly $3 per person. Ngele Ifoto, a Congo minister who ran a settlement program for displaced persons, observed, "Asia's crisis is temporary, while here we have a permanent catastrophe." In the mid-1980s, live aid brought a huge influx of Western dollars to combat famine in Ethiopia, and world leaders have brought media focus to the genocide taking place in Sudan's Darfur province. In the next year, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or AID, is planning to cut its assistance to the Congo by over $20 million, the result of elimination of emergency food aid. Still, 2 million Congolese remain in camps for displaced people, and thousands more now wander for food in the jungles of eastern Congo to escape renewed fighting. The government of Venezuela's populist president Hugo Chavez has launched a massive land redistribution campaign to hand out 100,000 parcels of land from existing state property or idle private land holdings. Eliezer Otaiza, head of the government's National Land Institute and a close Chavez ally, says over 40,000 land titles were researched in recent months, some dating back to 1847, to see if they were obtained legally. The huge land grant is scheduled to take place over the next 6 months in parcels ranging from 50 to 12,000 acres. Venezuela's controversial 2001 land reform law allows the government to hand over state property to poor farmers who must make productive use of the land. Over the last year, the National Land Institute has given 4.2 million acres of land to peasants. The land reform law also allows the national government to seize private land if it is not being farmed or if the owners did not obtain it legally. A survey in the late 1990s showed that 5% of farmers in Venezuela owned 75% of all farmland. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Before a Senate confirmation hearing January 6th, Alberto Gonzalez, President Bush's nominee to be the nation's next attorney general, repeatedly evaded questions about his involvement in writing memos that appear to authorize abuse and torture of prisoners held by the U.S. in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo, Cuba. While denying that he or the White House approve of the torture of prisoners, Gonzalez, in his role as counsel to President Bush, signed off on a very narrow definition of torture, which many observers say opened the door to the widely publicized abuses at the U.S.-run Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. A January 2002 memo signed by Gonzalez described some provisions of the Geneva Conventions as quaint and obsolete. At the Senate hearing, Mr. Gonzalez refused to renounce claims by the White House that the president has the authority to ignore anti-torture treaties, and went on to say that the administration was considering amending the Geneva Conventions. Among the many critics of the Gonzalez nomination are a dozen retired high-ranking U.S. military leaders, including generals and admirals, who assert that disregarding the Geneva Conventions undermines the rule of law and endangers the lives of American troops captured in battle. Also present at the hearings were members of Torture Abolition and Survivors Support Coalition International, or TASC. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with TASC's assistant director, Orlando Tizon, who survived torture under the Marcos dictatorship in the Philippines during 4 years of imprisonment from 1982 to 1986. Tizon explains why he and other victims of torture strongly oppose the nomination of Alberto Gonzalez to be Attorney General.
First of all, we really wanted to testify before the hearing. We wanted a survivor of torture to testify and to inform the panel, inform the committee, what torture really means for one who has suffered torture. And unfortunately, they did not allow us to testify. So we decided to make our presence felt and to protest the nomination of Mr. Gonzalez by attending the proceedings for the whole day. We were there, and we wore T-shirts that said, "Investigate Gonzalez," and at the back of our T-shirts, we said, "No torture." And we stood behind the room so that the senators could see us and read our message and be conscious of our presence there. There were about 20 survivors of torture who were there from different parts of the world.
Now, the conventional wisdom is that Alberto Gonzalez will be confirmed by the Senate, which is dominated by the Republicans, and that this issue of torture may soon be forgotten. What is your view? Why is it that you think Alberto Gonzalez should not be confirmed?
We believe that he is one of the legal authors of justification of torture. And we believe that he is one of the authors that penned different memoranda legalizing the use of torture in Afghanistan, Abu Ghraib, and in Guantanamo. We believe that he is one of the authors, if not the main author, of the August 2002 memo, giving a narrow definition of torture and saying that it is not torture unless it is pain equivalent to near death or the loss of an organ. In other words, redefining what the UN and other international bodies consider torture. Also, he is behind the January 2002 draft memo calling for a new paradigm on terrorism, which would render obsolete the Geneva Conventions, limiting the questioning of enemy prisoners. He is one of the legal authors behind this incidence of torture that we now know happened in Abu Ghraib and continues to happen in Iraq and Guantanamo and other places.
Alberto Gonzalez, during the Senate hearing, took great pains to state his opposition to torture. Do you believe Alberto Gonzalez when he states that he would not condone torture?
No. See, Scott, what really disappointed me was that he said that, of course, he does not approve of torture, and the Bush administration does not approve the use of torture, but he never admitted responsibility for these memos that led to the use of torture by rank-and-file agents of the U.S. government.
Orlando Tizan, what message will it send to the world at large if the U.S. Senate, as expected, confirms Alberto Gonzalez with his record of signing these memorandums approving of certain torture techniques?
We're giving a message that we treat the law very lightly. I mean, are we a nation of laws, or what respect for the law do we show this way by putting someone there to interpret the law for us who is proven to undermine international law and even domestic U.S. law? I think it gives a very, very poor message to the world about democratic processes and the rule of law that we should be following and that we want others to follow also.
As a survivor of torture and a U.S. citizen now, how does this this process and the likely approval of Alberto Gonzalez to be Attorney General, how does it affect you in your own life?
Well, it affects me in the sense, first of all, it makes me very sad. It makes me very sad. I'm not a U.S.-born citizen, but I care for all citizens here and all immigrants and refugees who come here and who come here because they believe that this is a country that respects laws and democratic processes. So it is sad, and I find it very disappointing. At the same time, I take it as a challenge, and a challenge for me to work harder at educating fellow Americans about the rights and educating Americans about torture. If we believe that we are a moral people and we follow the rule of law, then we have to educate ourselves about torture. And very few Americans, very few of us really know what torture means. And that is why TASC has come out so strongly that survivors should be allowed to speak because we consider ourselves the experts about torture, not lawyers, not therapists, not doctors, not psychologists. We are the experts about torture because we know what it means. We have gone through it.
That was Orlando Tizon, Assistant Director with Torture Abolition and Survivor Support Coalition International, or TASC. Contact TASC by calling area code 202-529-2991 or visit their website at www.tasc.org. For only the second time in 128 years, members of the U.S. Congress formally lodged a challenge to the certification of a presidential election. On January 6th, Representative Stephanie Tubbs Jones, a Democrat from Ohio, was joined by Senator Barbara Boxer, a California Democrat, in objecting to the certification of Ohio's 20 electoral votes on the basis of documented voting irregularities. Their action forced a constitutionally mandated two-hour debate in both the House and Senate. Following the debate, however, the challenge was rejected in the House 267-31. In the Senate, the tally was 74-1, with Barbara Boxer casting the only dissenting vote. The end to the 2004 presidential election came after a series of citizen-initiated hearings, protests, and independent investigations into voting irregularities in Ohio. The Green and Libertarian parties jointly demanded a recount of the votes cast in Ohio, but that controversial recount garnered President Bush's Democratic challenger, John Kerry, only 300 more votes. Representative John Conyers, Jr., a Democrat from Michigan, who had convened hearings to investigate the many irregularities, expressed his mistrust of the way the election in Ohio had been conducted. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bob Fratrakis, one of three attorneys disputing the results of the presidential election in Ohio before that state Supreme Court. Fratrakis, editor and publisher of the Columbus Free Press, assesses the historical significance of the formal challenge lodged in Congress against Ohio's electoral votes and the need to reform the nation's system of casting and counting ballots.
I think it was clearly a major historic victory to have a senator stand up and essentially go through the litany of the voter irregularities. And I think it's really the beginning of a new voters' rights movement that is going to bring us federal standards and perhaps constitutional amendment in the 21st century.
One thing that was interesting was the virtual lack of major media coverage of that event. The New York Times put it on page A19. Second time in 100 years that this was actually done, where a election certification was challenged.
And again, the other time it was one faithless elector. I mean, the law was enacted in 1887, and you had the 68 challenge to one elector who voted for Wallace instead of Nixon. But this is the only time in our history that an entire state's electoral college votes have been challenged.
What do you think the ripple effects of this challenge will be?
Well, I think the ripple effects will be people doing what we should have done a long time ago in this country. We can begin with the obvious, is that as long as you have private companies with secret proprietary software counting the votes when they clearly favor one candidate with no transparency, nobody can have faith in the votes. We might as well just hang a neon sign and say, commit fraud all you want. I mean, it's really faith-based vote counting. It's absurd. No democracy would accept it. And the lack of coverage by the mainstream media really shows the sorry state of corporate reporting. Really, this was driven by small newspapers, independent newspapers, web blogs, radio shows, alternative NPR community radio, and not by the mainstream media. In fact, the amazing thing is that this went forward despite attempts by John Kerry to scuttle it. So you had the Democrats and the Republicans trying to squash this movement, and it succeeded anyway.
What's the next move here on the part of activists and lawyers like yourself who are working to challenge the results of this election, but maybe even more importantly, work to reform the system so we don't have situations where votes are uncounted, where voters are intimidated, or votes are suppressed?
Well, I think we've got to dig in for the long haul here in Ohio. I think we've got to take the vote apart county by county, ward by ward, precinct by precinct, to show how faulty their numbers are. I mean, really outrageous. I mean, when you certify 124% voter turnout in two counties, and then it's always, well, that doesn't matter. It's just two counties where one precinct where there are 221 more votes than voters. But then when you have whole counties that you claim are voting in the 80 and 90%, Miami County, where you got a voter turnout of 98.55%, and they say everyone but 10 people votes, and you canvass it and immediately find 25 who didn't vote, it calls into question the whole integrity of the system. When you allow people's registrations to be thrown in the trash, when you allow the Secretary of State to be the co-chair of, the Bush-Cheney reelection committee, and then do a variety of blatantly partisan things like throwing out ballots because they're not an 80 bond paperweight as opposed to, say, 60, then, you've got a crisis of the system. When the machines break down everywhere, or you run an election with only half the machines you need. What's surprising is that the assumption of the mainstream media and some so-called progressive publications, that I've really been disappointed with their reporting. It's sort of like, well, if you don't have 119,000 votes to show me, don't bring it to my attention. If you're just talking about 20, 30, 40, 50,000 voters disenfranchised, what does it really matter?
What are the prospects for meaningful reform in the way we conduct elections in this country, standardizing machines, as you said, ensuring there's a paper backup for recounts, and doing all the other necessary things that would bring back people to have some faith in the system as it is run for elections, given that we have a Republican majority in both the House and Senate and a president in the White House, who all probably don't want any changes because they like it just fine the way it is?
Well, I think people didn't want reform, the majority of people in the South in the 1960s. I think the majority of people at various times in the history didn't want other types of reforms, didn't want peace in Vietnam. I think it really doesn't matter. And I have faith in the vast majority of the American people. Unless we restore faith in this system, people will seek other ways, ultimately more disruptive to seek social change. Since I'm a firm believer in democracy and transparency, I think we should demand of ourselves what we demand of the Ukraine and what we're trying to bring to Iraq. I mean, we're there bombing whole cities in order to bring a democracy and killing 100,000 civilians. And we don't meet our own standard of democracies in Ohio and throughout the United States.
That was Bob Fitrakis, one of three attorneys challenging the results of the presidential election in Ohio before that state's Supreme Court. For more information, visit the Columbus Free Press, an online investigative magazine, at www.freepress.org.
Oh, I'm sounding drums of war, said the man at his desk. Oh, I will not fight your war, said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and the will that he stood. Oh, I will not fight your war, said the child, and he stood.
As violence continues to escalate in advance of Iraqi elections scheduled for January 30th, the insurgency has assassinated several high officials of the U.S.-installed interim Iraqi government, including the governor of Baghdad province and Baghdad's deputy police chief and his son. The insurgents are employing new and more deadly tactics to attack U.S. troops by using powerful explosives to blow up heavily armored American military vehicles. Stephen Smith is a singer-songwriter and activist who has spoken out against the U.S. war in Iraq. His father was born there and now lives in the U.S., but Smith's entire extended family on his father's side continues to live in Iraq. Smith, who sometimes uses his birth father's name, Saeed, rather than his stepfather's name, recently established phone contact with many of his Iraqi relatives. His family members are Sunni Muslims, but did not cooperate with or support the Ba'athist regime of Saddam Hussein. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Smith, who shares some of what he recently discussed with his aunts, uncles, and cousins. Although he says they are afraid to give their opinions openly about the Iraqi election scheduled for January 30th or the anti-war movement in the U.S., Smith says they appreciate Americans standing against the occupation.
I think that there's a certain desire to distance oneself from both sides. It depends, of course, on who you're going to speak to. But even distancing oneself from them, there's undeniable support, at least for the fight against the occupation, regardless of whether or not, let's say, a silenced majority there really just wants peace and has a hard time supporting the Mahdi army, let's say, on one hand, or supporting the occupation, because they just, you know, what the resistance now, they say, is maybe 100,000 people. Has it gone up to 150,000 people? The country's got, what, 25 million people in it? What about the 24,800,000 people there that aren't in the resistance? That's who I'm talking about trying to give voice to. Now, lots of people who were not supportive of Saddam Hussein now also say they wish Saddam Hussein was back because they can't eat, they can't go to school, they have no water. As my uncle, Hazi, told me in my last conversation with him a few days ago, the number one thing that they've lost entirely is security. And albeit they had security by the arm of the military under Saddam Hussein, but security in Iraq was probably greater than in any other Arabic nation until the invasion. Now it's probably the least secure country in the region. You know, I can't speak to my family about anything in detail, even though they're, you know, they're doctors in the main hospitals, they're former service people in high-ranking positions in the government. I can't speak to them about all that they know because they're afraid they're going to be killed for talking to me on the phone. It's hard for them to speak on the phone now, pro or anti-U.S. or pro or anti-insurgency. They're damned if they do, damned if they don't, on either side. And this is the majority of the people that live there. Things are not separated or segregated like people, like the media leads us to believe. I mean, Shia and Sunni and Kurds talk to each other. They lived side by side together for hundreds and hundreds of years and intermingled. You know, the divisiveness has been blown out of proportion for political power.
You've talked about this a little bit, but can you say more about how bad things really are for your family under the U.S. occupation?
I think on really bad days or bad times or weeks, if, you know, with electrical rations and so on and so forth, they can't get water now, and sometimes they can, and the phone lines are, you know, I couldn't reach them for months. Now I seem to be able to get through to them again more often than not. I know that, you know, there's been months and times when my cousins couldn't go to school. I know that in Mosul, it's much worse right now for my family, because that's where my family's from. Things there have been bad because the entire city shut down, as my uncle said. He was there for Ramadan feast and couldn't leave for 2 weeks to go back home to Baghdad because the invasion of Fallujah, this last invasion of Fallujah, started during that time. And that created an insurgent uprising in Mosul, as we know, that continues to today, and was so bad that there was so much fear in the city that nobody opened their shops, nobody opened their schools, nobody opened anything. It was like a deserted ghost town, and nobody could leave.
We hear very little about how daily life is for women in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, and it depends on what part of the, this is such a diverse culture. I do know that things are worse and worse as fundamentalism is allowed to rise. And it's very difficult, like, for our family because, you know, we remember a Middle East, particularly Iraq, that was so far ahead of its time and having some liberations for women. But my aunts have been doctors and teachers for years, since the 50s. There was a lot more freedom for them than there is now. The more fundamentalism rises in reaction to oppression and occupation, the worse things are actually going to get. I think the occupation has done nothing but create a climate that is more and more adverse for women.
You have so many relatives who are doctors. Do they see the results of depleted uranium use on the civilian population?
Two aunts work in a hospital, in main hospitals in Baghdad, and two in Mosul. And so they're seeing and have been seeing for over 12 years continuous and increasing injuries and increasing illnesses and cancers and malformations, deformities from depleted uranium. But these are only starting to show up now. 2 years is about the time when the gestation and the results start to show up. So now we're starting to see the first babies born damaged by this invasion's droppings. They feel like they've been poisoned. They feel like their country is being poisoned, and it seems to them that it's intentional. I mean, when your entire country is getting littered with stuff and everybody knows that it has radioactivity, even if it's low radioactivity, but it's not going anywhere for thousands of years, you've got to start to wonder if it's intentional.
That was singer-songwriter Stephen Smith, who speaks often by phone with his relatives in Baghdad and Mosul, Iraq. An essay he wrote about these conversations appeared online at commondreams.org. For information on Smith's music and touring schedule, visit his website at www.stephensmith.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.